Bill Teeple, and here with Alan Cobb and Donna Colby, and this is Icon Art Radio. Well, I was telling these guys before we went on the air about what I'm doing with the art. My class is called The Quest for Beauty, which I do twice a year. And we run through the range of art history, and I reflect on it as an artist and a curator. We broadly categorize the periods of art, and one of the areas that we're coming to now is I've called industrialization. And it's usually to show, I mean, in that section, I show what's going on in England, especially as counterpoint to what's going on in France, where we had the Impressionist movement, which really entered the history books as the major transforming force in art history, the Impressionists and Post-Impressionists in France, which was really a major paradigm shift in art history from the Renaissance period into the modern period. I call it the pivot point. In England, there was a similar sort of change taking place, and it began with the critic Ruskin, who started to try to get people to look at art prior to the High Renaissance as having some kind of art value, because medieval art was considered primitive and just leading up, like a learning period leading up to actually knowing how to make art, which was achieved in the high art of the period of Raphael and Da Vinci and Titian in Rome in around 1500. So we had this group called the Pre-Raphaelites developing in England, which was a kind of a ragtag group of young men, all inspired by Ruskin, and they started to do artwork that was more of a Gothic flavor. And so they went away from the realism of Renaissance rendering and started flattening space and using more Gothic vehicles of expression. And they liked the idea of connecting what they were doing with literature. And there was a sort of an integration of literature and art. And there was one particular Pre-Raphaelite named William Morris, who was doing the very same thing. He did some paintings of the Arthurian legends, and he sort of recognized that although he was inspired by all of this and was doing some of it, he wasn't a genius or a master painter. He was never going to quite do what his fellow Pre-Raphaelites were achieving in terms of skill in drawing and painting and expression that way. But what he was in love with design. He was a master designer. And he also was, there was, what was happening in Europe at that time, especially in England, was what we call industrialization. There was starting to be mass production of goods, so everybody could have something, but everything that was produced was very cheaply done and all looked alike. And he felt that craftsmanship in that art and craftsmanship in the production of objects for everyday living was getting lost. And he wanted to revive the relationship of the fine artist and everyday objects. So he spent the rest of his life designing and creating fabrics, wallpapers, carpet designs, tapestries, all these things that had to do with how you decorated your home, because he felt that that was on the verge of getting lost. It brings up some interesting juxtapositions. Let me read some of this from my notes here. And this was known as the Arts and Crafts Movement of William Morris. It was a reaction to industrialization. They were concerned about the loss of craftsmanship to machine-made, the loss of personal to impersonal, the loss of beauty of materials to modern materials, the loss of aesthetics to functional, and the loss of hominess to utilitarian. And it sort of brings back, having done this art history course, it brings back the more integrated state that went on in primitive cultures, or in the cultures of indigenous peoples, where there wasn't such a distinction between art and life. We had gotten to, in the 19th century, we had gotten to the point where there was fine art, and then there was, you know, living life, and they had kind of gotten separated. Back in the days of tribal life, people would spend, it was really a struggle to survive, and yet people would spend hours and hours making a basket that was beautiful, as opposed to just a basket that would carry water or carry stuff. And so I think William Morris was trying to bring us back to a time when aesthetics was embedded more in everyday utilitarian objects. Now you brought up, before we went on the air, where is the line between, you know, the beauty of function? And I mean, because there was a whole movement in the modern period that said that something that is absolutely functional has beauty of function. So,
yeah, well, you know, I was just thinking as you were talking about two very different things. On the one hand, I was thinking of the incomparable Washeshu basket weaver, Datso Lali, who made baskets that people traveled literally all the way across the United States to see. And I was also thinking, and these were just woven out of, you know, grass, basically, reeds and things. But she was really good at it, and she was extremely unappealing to the eye and had lived all her life, most of her life, as a kind of a lonely person. And this impresario came to Nevada and saw her work and fell in love with it. And so they got married. And she lived with him for the rest of their lives. I don't know who went first, but she made a priceless collection of baskets, living in comfort and good health in his home as his wife. And he made a lot of money selling these baskets because they were simply unbelievable. I mean, I've seen some. They're still around in museums and things in Nevada. And they're, I mean, she makes little tiny ones that are 2 inches in diameter. And they're like jewels. They're just impossible. And then there are big ones. But they don't look like baskets. They come on like fine ceramics. The alignment of the fibers of the reeds that they're woven from is perfect, and the glistening of the you know material that they're made out of gives them an otherworldly quality, and they seem like they're not made out of, they couldn't be made out of just plants that somebody ripped out of the ground and tangled up. Datso Lali.
Datso Lali.
All 4 separate words as it's transliterated. I don't know what the proper Washeshu pronunciation was. And there are pictures of her. This was, you know, late 19th century, maybe even early 20th century. And there are photos of her sitting there and making baskets and holding baskets and things. And then the other thing I was thinking, and this is where it's sort of form and function in an interesting dimension, because the skill that's embodied in it becomes one of the strongest aesthetic qualities. It's not the way the baskets are decorated, and it's not that they're necessarily better baskets functionally than another basket, and it's not that they have been made purely to fulfill the physical requirements of a basket that makes them so special. It's the skill, really. It's the incredible talent and devotion of the creator that went into them. And then this other issue is the motorcycle. Now, we have decorated motorcycles, and I'm not particularly interested in them. Some of them are wonderfully done. What appeals to me primarily is the motorcycle whose embellishment is non-existent, essentially, where form follows function completely. And to me, the most beautiful motorcycles are the old Ducati open frame machines and old Triumphs and BSA Gold Stars and things, where it's just an engine, a frame that holds the engine, two wheels, rear suspension, front suspension, tank, seat, handlebars, headlight, taillight, pegs for your feet, a few levers and cables are required, and you're done. But for some reason, certain ones of those, and they tend to be the ones that have the best road handling ability, and they tend to be the ones that were the most popular, certain ones are just stunning to look at. Once, of course, you have to develop some sensibility for appreciating how a motorcycle looks, and ideally on the basis of experience of using one, because we're talking about form following function. But what a difference in aesthetic, you know, between Dotsolali baskets and, say, a BSA, you know, DBD Clubman Gold Star, which is instantly recognizable to anyone who has admired the evolution of the engineering of a motorcycle. It doesn't represent any kind of spectacular technology breakthrough. It's just somehow all the requirements came together in something that's also aesthetically totally satisfying. And it's almost as though you can see that it's going to work really well when you look at it. And somehow, for that reason, you appreciate it in a special way. And yet, both of these are, in a sense, industrial art. You know, they're purely practical. Nobody's doing it as a work of art.
Yeah. Well, and I think that's true for all sorts of, like, other vehicles as well. Bicycles,
oh, sure.
And airplanes,
sure.
And
Bugattis and
cars,
yeah.
And all of that. And also other utilitarian items like cups and bowls, mm-hmm. And, you know, eating utensils and,
sure.
And absolutely. Coffee makers, you know, absolutely anything. You go into a store that sells objects like that, whether they're manufactured or made by hand, and you look at the array of them on the shelf, and there are certain ones that stand out as just being so gorgeous that you almost mm-hmm. don't even care whether they work better than or less. You know, I've bought things that were not rated as highly in performance, appliances and things like that, just because they were so much more beautiful.
Yeah.
That I wanted that sitting on my counter instead of the other one that maybe worked better.
I'm reminded of that classic orange juicing object that has three spider legs kind of zigzagging out of it, and it doesn't look like it could possibly be a kitchen utensil, but it in fact is perfect for, you know, hand squeezing half an orange. And I think it's in the, you know, MoMA permanent collection, mm-hmm. along with a whole lot of other things in that category. And there's an experience for someone visiting New York. Go look at the industrial art at the Museum of Modern Art. Mm-hmm. It's arresting.
Mm-hmm. Now, do they have only whole machines, or do they have machine parts in there? Because I think machine parts can be gorgeous.
Parts are great.
Beautiful little sculptures.
Yeah. Well, you know, my this line of sculptural speakers that I'm working on now is really based on celebrating the visual appearance of sound-making devices. Mm. You know,
oh,
they're speakers,
cool.
Raw speaker drivers like the ones in the that I used in the four speakers installation. But I want to showcase them. I want to make something beautiful that just celebrates that particular driver. And it makes sound. Mm. And maybe the sound that comes out of it is dedicated to the sculpture. Maybe it's not a general purpose loudspeaker. And it certainly isn't going to be audiophile, high-end audio equipment. But it's just so wonderful to see that. I mean, I used to have a Gold Star piston on my desk. You know, I had it with me all the time because it was just really nice. Or a nice connecting rod, you know. This can be a very beautiful thing.
Well, and also when you have a beautiful tool, you approach the work differently. It's like Duncan McMaster's workshop, where he has all of the Japanese, beautifully made Japanese tools all lined up in a row of all the different sizes and all that. And you can tell that when he's working with one of those tools, he's going to be working differently than if he were using some plastic-handled tool that he bought at Walmart or something, which he probably doesn't even own any. But there's, when you even look at those tools, even if I don't know what they're for, I don't even know how you use those wood crafting tools, it makes me want to respect them, and it makes me curious about what you do with them, and makes me realize that if I ever did learn how to do that, I would approach it more like I was dancing with the tool or something like that than if I were then
just becomes like, a ceremonial
There's something different about it. Even kitchen tools are like that. If I happen to buy some really beautiful one at the at-home store that's just puts that particular mixing tool or whatever on a different into a different category of an art object, I will enjoy cooking with it and slow down a little bit in the experience of using that than if I were just using something that was utilitarian.
My father was a spinal surgeon, and he designed his own surgical instruments. And I remember asking, and he had a tool room at home where we did, he kept tools for carpentry and plumbing and electrician work and stuff, because he did all of that too. And I remember as a kid asking him, what's the difference between, you call your surgical things instruments, and these are tools, but they both involve hammers and chisels and things like that. What's the difference between a tool and an instrument? And he thought for a minute, and he said, a tool is the instrument of another man's trade.
Well, I think what we see here is that you, it's very difficult to extricate form from function or function from form, that they're very integrated. What we found with the arts and crafts movement is that they did such a wonderful job of creating these incredible fabrics and beautiful designs and very well woven works and stained glass and all of this, that only the wealthy could afford them. But this is a little bit of a problem.
And yet they're, you know, if you look at the folk art, as we call it sort of condescendingly, of other cultures where they have the time to make these things, they spend, as you mentioned at the very beginning, you know, an inordinate number of hours making something that's purely something they have to have. They're not necessarily using spare time on it. It's more that it's important for it to be a good one, and so it become, it gets decorated. The colorful fabrics that they weave for their everyday clothing, and it has there's a tribal or cultural style to it. But they don't have to make it in multicolors, and they don't have to, you know, have fringe on it, and they don't have to add the beads and the decorations and all of those things. It's just how you do it when you make clothing. So even there, they haven't separated the decoration from the essential function. It's as though it's just this you know, family is better at making digging tools than that family, even though everybody kind of makes his own digging tools. The ones that these people make are better, or the clothing that this person makes is better than the clothing that that person makes. And the betterness may be that the sewing is better and it doesn't fall apart as soon, or it may be that it's just more beautiful. And it's hard to say whether that's even not part of its function. It may be as important as keeping you warm.
Well, and it can have a community function as well as a practical function. And I think that's what's happening today. We have our own arts and crafts movement going on today in this period in history, where with the whole locally made products movement, which is not just happening here in Fairfield, but all over the country, maybe other places in the world as well, where it's another wave of reaction against industrialization, instead of, you know, giving all of the power for providing us with goods to big corporations and huge business conglomerates and everything, to bring it back into the community and support the local craftspeople. And people are getting more and more behind that, I think, all over the country.
And the idea of having a locally made, handcrafted something instead of a Walmart something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, you want things to be a little special. And yet, at the same time, you know, there are people who want to have the national brand on the outside of their shirt so that everyone will know that they picked the right one. And that has nothing to do with the shape or color or functionality of the clothing. It has to do with a badge of membership in an unspoken social organization.
Well, and that can apply even to like handcrafted things too that come along. Yeah. That in a community there's some prestige in having the carved box made by this guy because
sure.
he's gained some great reputation in the community. Everybody wants one, like this woman's baskets you were talking about in mm-hmm. Nevada. Probably once people found out that
oh,
she
yeah.
existed,
well, that's
it was
why they
just
were
like
so expensive.
Huge.
In the time that they were making them, and I'm embarrassed to say I don't remember if it was 1890 or 1920, they were selling for hundreds of dollars.
Wow, even back
which
then,
means yeah. they were probably, some of them were what we would consider tens of thousands of dollars. Mm. It was quite an amazing phenomenon.
And are they all in museums now, probably, huh?
Well, most are
or
lost, but
collections.
The ones that exist are mostly, I think, in private collections. Mm. There was a lot of investing in baskets back then. They were, I mean, they were a known value, you know, commodity.
Mm. So, when I'm thinking back again at the indigenous peoples, it's like taken for granted that you not only will make the pot, but you'll make it beautiful. I mean, that
yeah.
you'll incorporate the designs that we have used
yeah.
again and again and again, and you'll do it in a certain way, and certain families will make better pots than others, but they'll probably all follow a certain kind of patterning.
Yeah.
And I feel like it's not unlike that a woman or even a man in those days would just spontaneously decorate their bodies because there was something joyful in enhancing your body with, say, earrings or some tattoos.
Mm-hmm.
And the same, so the pot and the instruments of living and the dwellings and these things were dealt with almost exactly like you would deal with your body in terms of, there wasn't such a separation between getting it done, functionality and beauty and living. And
I think there was a big emphasis on how you do it. It took a while to learn how to do it. The tools didn't lend themselves to getting it done in an afternoon. So it was a multi-week project to make a spoon or something, whatever it might have been. Maybe not multi-weeks for a spoon, but anyway. I see a correlation between the length of time it takes to transfer the skill and the length of time it takes to make the thing, so that the emphasis becomes one of following the process the right way.
Mm-hmm.
And in our culture, we go and get it. We don't do it, we get it. We just go buy it. And so if its appearance reflects some aspect of how it was made, maybe that's cool. Maybe not being able to tell how it was made is cool, because I mean, I find that appealing also. I like to see objects that are just sort of pure form and you can't tell. There's no parting line from a mold. There's no machining marks on it, and no glue seams. And you have no idea. It's like a sort of an abstract thing that popped into existence in the way that it already is. But at the same time, things that are rustic and handmade have another appeal because you see evidence of the craftsman behind it, and that's interesting too. And I guess it just seems like humans like to decorate things and they like to get into things, they like to get into what they do. They're not likely to do anything in a perfunctory manner if they have a choice.
And if they have the time.
Well, that's what I mean by the choice.
Really, like you said before, these cultures that are really in survival mode, basically, and they're just, you know, life is spent finding food and being protected from wild animals or whatever.
They still find the time.
Longest time creating objects like that.
So yeah.
I suppose it's because that's not just their way of making products they need, but it's also, in a sense, their entertainment. It's like they don't have movies to go to and all of the other things that we do in the Western world for entertainment, and so to satisfy that part of themselves that wants to interact with beauty, they make these utilitarian objects as art objects, entertainment.
Yeah. Well, which shows that doing something in an interesting way is intrinsically interesting.
Yeah, right.
And that comes back to, you know, one of the definitions of art that sticks in my mind, which is simply performing an action with deliberation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Performing an act, doing something intentionally, sort of. And it takes you from just doing it to doing it in a particular way, whatever that happens to be.
Yeah, and I think for us in this day and age, it can be rare unless we design our lives around giving us spacious time in order to do that. It can be something that only occurs once in a while, and when it happens to occur, that we have the time to work intentionally like that for as long as it takes, there's something so extraordinarily satisfying about it because of its rarity in our busy lives. And for me, sometimes when that happens, it makes me realize how much I've missed that aspect of life and how I actually need to organize my time to schedule that in, even if it means blocking it in like an appointment.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.